Hi, this is Margot Adler, director of Beaker Street. We're really excited to bring you this Mona Foma special edition of PsyArt Walks, an audio series we created for the unusual circumstances of our 2020 Beaker Street Festival. If you're not familiar with Beaker Street Festival, it's a celebration of science, art, music, and Tassie food and booze that happens every August throughout the state, with a hub at the Tasmanian Museum and Art Gallery. Check it out at beakerstreet.com.au and come along in August. Each episode of PsyArt Walks features a talk by one of Tassie's many brilliant scientists and cultural figures, paired with music originally composed and performed by Tasmanian artists. The music is inspired by the topic of the talk and a suggested walking location in Tasmania. For this episode, we're suggesting you listen while walking around Launceston's stunning Cataract Gorge. We've recorded a special introduction with Brian Ritchie, curator of Mona Foma and bass guitarist with the Violent Femmes. He'll walk you through how he made the music for the episode. First, I'd like to thank our project sponsors and partners, Detached Cultural Organization, City of Hobart, Events Tasmania, National Science Week, and the Tasmanian Museum and Art Gallery. Now, here's Brian.
Hi, I'm Brian Ritchie. I am the curator of Mona Foma, Museum of Old and New Art, Festival of Music and Art. Barbara Holland created a talk about math and evolution, focusing on Launceston's beautiful Cataract Gorge as a site and using it to explore various ideas about early humanoids and their relationship with nature. And my task was to come up with a musical soundtrack for this talk. I decided it wouldn't really be appropriate to do something like a really funky groove or acid house or playing some blues or any other kind of known musical format. So instead, I decided to focus on instruments that actually sound like nature and that are, in some cases, made from natural materials without really much intervention, and decided to make a soundtrack that would blend in with the sounds that people hear when they're walking through the gorge rather than trying to compete with them or defeat them. So I listened to Barbara's talk and walked in the gorge myself and kind of meditated on what would be appropriate. So I decided to limit myself to a palette of instruments from nature. Now, this is a tsuchibue, which is a Japanese clay flute, which was used by the Stone Age people in Japan, and they still use it for certain things. And you'll hear that this blends in with wind sounds and the sounds of nature so much that you would not necessarily identify it as a musical instrument. So that would easily blend in with the sound of the river and wind in the gorge. Another instrument that I used, they're stones. So I used them in two different ways. One was as percussion instruments. And the other is called an iwabue, which is a Japanese word for stone flute. And these stones have holes in them, which I use in a flute-like manner. But there's been no human intervention whatsoever. You're just blowing on stones that have natural holes in them. This mimics the sound of birds. So that's a hole that goes through the flute, and I'm blowing in one end and moving my finger around on the other end. Here's a particularly good sounding iwabue that has a wide range of pitch. And another thing that I did was to use actually a shrub that I found in my yard to create a kind of a percussive sound just by shaking it. Of course, this is reminiscent of the sound of wind through the trees or bushes in the gorge. And the final sound that I used was a Japanese shakuhachi, Japanese bamboo flute. But I used an extremely big one to also imitate the sound of the wind. After recording all of these sounds, Chris Townend, who is a fantastic recording engineer and record producer, took the sounds and mixed them together and blended them in with Barbara's talk. So Barbara's voice telling the story, the music that I created, which is an imitation of nature, and the sound of nature itself that you'll hear in the gorge, harmoniously blend for one distinct experience.
You're listening to SciArt Walks, brought to you by Beaker Street. The episodes in this series are best paired with fresh air, and each has a suggested walking location in Tasmania. You can get information on each walk at sciartwalks.com.au. If you can't make it to the suggested walking location, that's okay. You can just go there in your mind. But we do recommend listening to this episode outdoors, preferably in nature. The Peace of Wild Things by Wendell Berry. When despair for the world grows in me, and I wake in the night at the least sound, in fear of what my life and my children's lives might be, I go and lie down where the wood drake rests in his beauty on the water, and the great heron feeds. I come into the peace of wild things who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I come into the presence of still water. And I feel above me the day-blind stars waiting with their light. For a time I rest in the grace of the world and am free. Using Maths and Evolution to Connect All Living Things. A talk by Professor Barbara Holland with music by Brian Ritchie. The suggested walking location for this episode is Cataract Gorge, Launceston.
Hi, I'm Professor Barbara Holland. I'm from the University of Tasmania in the School of Natural Sciences, and I work in the mathematics discipline. I would like to acknowledge and pay respect to the Tasmanian Aboriginal community as the traditional and original owners and continuing custodians of this land. It's funny to think about as you're wandering around a place like Cataract Gorge, it's at the edge of the sort of an intersection of the urban environment and the natural world. Just sort of as you open your eyes and think about who you're coming across, who do you meet? That you might obviously meet other people. And one of the things that might like to think about if you sort of look at a stranger, supposedly, is that, you know, you have your ancestry. So you have your parents, or we think about just our mum, say your mum in particular. So think about your mum and her mum and her mum. And that if the stranger that you're looking at thinks about their mum and then their mum and their mum, that inevitably at some point you're going to hit the same person. That so any human you meet, if you go back long enough, you're going to find some shared ancestry. So if we take this idea of common ancestry of two people, then we can keep thinking about that. Well, what about we think of, you know, all the people in Launceston or all the people in Tasmania or even all the people in the whole world? We can follow that same process of tracing back ancestry. And at some point, we're going to get to a common ancestor. One of the interesting ways we can explore when and even where that common ancestor existed is through genetics and through looking at DNA. And by looking at sort of shared genetic information between different individuals, we're able to get a good idea of where the common ancestor of all humans originated. But we can follow that thought even further. If you're walking through the gorge, you might look around, you might be seeing, you know, some fun mammals. There might be a paddy melon hopping around, or you might hear some birds chirping in the trees. And that same idea that we can continue to trace ancestry, we don't need to stop at the ancestor of all humans. We could keep going back through before the dawn of modern humans. We're going to at some point get to a common ancestor with other primates, then other mammals. And then if we keep tracing ancestry back, we're going to get to some creature that existed at some point in time, which was the ancestor of all, not only all humans and all mammals, but all birds as well. And it's kind of fascinating to me to think that if you follow this process for long enough, that basically all life on Earth is related. And even more wonderful is the fact that we still have a glimpse of what those relationships might be by being able to study information that is left in DNA and in people's genetics. My research has, so I'm in a mathematics department, but the area that I like to think about or apply mathematics to is evolutionary biology. And I'm really interested in this question of, okay, so now we can do lots and lots of DNA sequencing. It's become reasonably cheap and efficient to sequence, you know, genomes of many humans or plants or animals. What biological insight can we then extract from all of that data we've got, all of that biological data? And some really interesting biological questions come up, like how are different species related? So this is known as the field of phylogenetics, which is basically like if you think about your family tree, but then sort of extend that idea out to species, you're asking those questions of how recently did these two species share a common ancestor, or are birds and cats more closely related to each other than, say, dogs and horses, or like these sorts of questions, like what are the relationships? So they're kind of biological questions, but it turns out that to come up with good answers to them, you really need to apply a lot of mathematics and statistics, which has always been my passion. And so, yeah, I remember quite clearly the day that I realised how much mathematics there was in biology. I was living in New Zealand and I was doing my PhD at the time on vehicle transportation problems, which no doubt is a fascinating problem, but one that I had got a little bit bored with. And I just randomly went to a lunchtime seminar on bioinformatics. And I didn't even really know what the word bioinformatics meant at the stage that I went to this talk. But I found out, you know, about all these problems, like if you have DNA from two different species and you want to be able to somehow line it up and look and see how it's similar or different, then that's somehow a mathematical optimization problem. or if you want to try and pick between all the different ways a group of species could be related, again, that's a mathematical optimization problem, because you need clever ways to search through the space of trees and all the possible ways that different things could be related. One of the things that amazed me as a mathematician when I got into this area is how unbelievably passionate evolutionary biologists are about things that happened a stupidly long time ago. One of the very first conferences I ever went to, I came around a corner and I saw two academics in what I thought was about to be a fist fight with spit flying. And I turned to the person next to me and I said, What are David and Lyndall arguing about? And they said, the Cambrian explosion. I'm like, what's that? When did that happen? And they said, well, about 500 million years ago. I'm like, wow, it's just, you know, it's incredible, the level of passion. Dave Penny was my PhD supervisor, and it was just a fantastic, wonderful man to work with. He was just very, very firmly believed, almost like it was a religion in this Popperian view of life, that for a theory to be scientific, that it has to be testable and falsifiable. And it sort of built his career around, you know, trying to demonstrate that evolution did make falsifiable and testable predictions. One of the things that always got him really hot under the collar was the KT boundary. And I think everyone from primary school upwards knows the story that the dinosaurs were happily roaming around until one day the sky darkened, a massive asteroid approaches, and boom, hits the Earth, and poor old dinosaurs go extinct. Then I guess, I don't know, maybe we wait a million years or so, but eventually scurrying around the forest floor, there emerge some mammals and birds, and they go on to inherit the Earth. And Dave Penny thought this was ridiculous. He said, there's no evidence for that. Just because two things happen to occur at the same time doesn't mean they're related. We know we need to actually test this idea. And he used to say, it's a communist view of evolution because it denies a role for competition. And so his alternative idea was that, in fact, dinosaurs were on their way out long before the asteroid hit, and that little proto-mammals had started scurrying around, maybe eating dinosaur eggs, putting them under some evolutionary pressure, and that maybe dinosaurs would have gone extinct even without the asteroid. The point of this isn't, you know, who's right. Is it David or is it the more mainstream view? But the point of it is that you can make a testable prediction, that if you really believe that the asteroid wipes out the dinosaurs and then birds and mammals inherit the Earth, that makes a specific prediction about an evolutionary tree, which is that when you go back to about 65 million years ago, you should see a sudden burst of new species. So you should have a very small number of lineages that cross this KT boundary at 65 million years ago, and then they should very rapidly diversify. Whereas if you prefer the mammals out competing the dinosaurs philosophy, then you expect to see a different picture. You expect to see many lineages potentially crossing the KT boundary and not having ancestors until further in the past, maybe 80, 100 million years ago. So a phylogenetic tree is basically a family tree that you could, if you're walking around just looking at an actual tree, even this is a good visual analogy, that you have at the tips, you'd imagine your species label. So if you're looking at a tree and at the top of the branches, you might sort of think of a label human, chimpanzee, orangutan sitting at the top of different branches. And then as you trace back from the tips inside in towards the center of the tree, at some point you're going to get back to, you know, a point where two branches meet. And that's the idea of a common ancestor. And so when we're drawing a phylogenetic tree, we're trying to work out two things, really. One is what's the sort of the length of those branches, where you're thinking sort of in potentially tens of millions of years, so quite ancient timescales. So how long ago did things happen? And also what order did things happen? So if I start at the tip that has human and chimpanzee and trace back till I get to a common ancestor, does that happen before or after? If, say, I started at the two tips that said chimpanzee and orangutan and traced them back and got a common ancestor. And so it's the order in which different relationships occur and also the timing that are both of interest. So obviously since, you know, Darwin had the idea that all species might be related by a single evolutionary tree, there have been, you know, some people that are just, you know, curious to then know, well, what is that tree? Just sort of intellectually, like, it's fun to know how everything is related. But then there's other people who are more practical about these things and say, well, why? Why would you care how different species are related? And, you know, that's a good question. But trees actually tell you some pretty, phylogenetic trees, that is, or evolutionary trees, tell you some really interesting stuff about the past. So one of the questions that, say, biogeographers might have is, well, why do certain species exist in some places but not in others? Why do we have, like, these distributions of plants and animals? And so two different theories of how species come to be in different places are one called vicariance, which is a big fancy word, but it basically means rafting, as much as far as I can tell, that you are on whatever continent you're on, and then, you know, plate tectonics might move continents around slowly over many millions of years, and species raft around on their continents, and when continents bump into each other, you know, species can move around. Whereas another theory is that animals and plants can get dispersed over even large distances of ocean. Maybe, I don't know, if you're a seed of a plant, maybe you get stuck in the feathers of a bird and it gets blown by a storm to some, you know, to New Zealand from Australia or vice versa. So how would you sort of tease apart these competing theories of how plants and animals get where they are today? Well, phylogenetics can basically help you with that. If things mostly got around by rafting and vicariance, then when we built phylogenetic trees of species in New Zealand and Australia, we'd expect that they might be, you know, 80 million years of time between them, because that's about how long ago it was that those different regions were joined. Whereas if things get blown back and forth a lot, then you'd expect a very different pattern, that there might be lots of instances of, say, Australian and New Zealand plants that share a common ancestor maybe 2 or 3 million years ago. And in fact, that is what you do find. You find plenty of instances of dispersal. Why else might you care about a phylogenetic tree? Well, as you're walking through the gorge, you might be keeping an eye on your feet or just being a little bit cautious about the fact that there could be some snakes, you know, rustling around in the undergrowth there. And if by some unlucky chance you were to get bitten by one of these snakes, there's, you know, one fortunate thing that you can have in your mind is that the antivenom that would needed to be used to save you is very well determined by a phylogenetic tree. So if you look at, if you know how different snakes are related evolutionarily, you can find that the antivenom that works on one snake works on all the other, like, closely related snakes. And so, you know, in Australia, the knowing the phylogenetic tree of snakes is actually really important for knowing what antivenoms will work on against what bites. Another thing that has been in the news a lot recently, of course, is the COVID pandemic. And in general, phylogenetics has a lot to say about origins. So where did particular viruses come from? And a lot of viruses that affect humans, COVID included, are what are known as zoonoses. So they've basically been viruses for a long time in other animals, and then they manage to jump across somehow into humans. And by building a phylogenetic tree of different related sets of viruses, you can learn basically where sort of human instances of particular viruses have come from. There's a lot of interest at the moment in where COVID originated, and that is basically a phylogenetic question that you can sequence the COVID virus and compare it to other similar viruses and other species and try and work out what's the most similar thing. I haven't read the most recent papers on this, but I understand that a non-conspiracy theory, just standard zoonosis, is the most likely explanation, and that it has basically managed to jump somehow from an animal species at one point in time into humans. One of the great playground questions of all time is this classic argument: which came first, the chicken or the egg? And so it's kind of fun to think about these things. Well, how would you have chickens before eggs? But if you didn't have eggs, who would be laying the chickens? No, wait. If you didn't have chickens, who would be laying the eggs? That's right. But phylogenetics actually gives us a kind of an answer to this question, as you can look at all of the different modern chicken species and subspecies, of which there are, you know, quite a few, and you can trace them back until you get to a common ancestor. Or even more broadly, you could look at birds and trace them back and see when you got to a common ancestor. And then you can do the same thing with eggs. And eggs are interesting because certainly birds have eggs, but lots of reptiles lay eggs as well. And so if you then trace back to try and find a common ancestor of all the different things that have eggs, you actually get back to about 300 million years ago, which is a long way before chickens, obviously. So phylogenetics believes it has the definitive answer to the chicken-egg conundrum. Eggs came first by about 300 million years. DNA is a molecule that is basically for recording information. And in the same way as a computer, like when you boil down to it, it's all just, you know, zeros and ones organized in some way that convey information. DNA, again, just works with a really small alphabet. So basically the only letters it can use are A, C, G, and T. And these aren't really letters, they're actually, you know, molecules. They're what do they stand for? Cytosine, guanine, adenine, and thymine. But the molecules that then get attached in a particular order, and then that creates a code that can get read by, I suppose, other machinery in the cell. So one of the fun things about, I guess, studying evolution, as opposed to if you're a, you know, an engineer where you might use tools from calculus a lot, is that evolution has randomness in it. That, you know, mutations don't happen in a deterministic way, they happen in a chance way. And so you need the maths that you use to try and understand things has to think about chance and probability and randomness and, you know, the multiple possible ways things could have turned out. So people tend to think about, when you talk about evolution, the first thing people think of is natural selection and, say, organisms or species trying to adapt to their environment and get better. From a mathematical point of view of, like, trying to use genetic information to work out history in the past and how things are related, like, sure, there are some mutations that help species adapt better, but what we actually like to focus on are the mutations that don't do anything. So just neutral mutations. So some bit of DNA changes, but it doesn't happen to be important or make you any more or less fit. So while they might kind of seem like the boring mutations, they're actually the most informative ones from the point of view of trying to work out how things are related, because they're sort of unbiased by not having anything to do with selection. So what is a mutation really? So every time you need to, you know, make a new cell in your body, you're going to have to copy your genetic code. And I guess from the point of view of evolution, that the interesting mutations are the ones that occur in gametes, so when you're making eggs or sperm that are going to be turned into a new creature, any mutations that happen there have potential to be passed on. So that might just be you know, simply the process of copying the DNA, which I guess mathematically I like to think of somehow as just a big long string of A's, C's, G's and T's, that you're one of these, there's an accident. And so your mum might have been CCTTA and you get CCTTG. So there's just one little bit that has a change. And it could be that that change makes you slightly less fit or slightly less good at something. And over the really long evolutionary run, maybe you're going to be less likely to have fit descendants because of this mutation. Or it could be that the mutation just doesn't really do very much at all. It could be in a place where it doesn't affect the amino acids. So your DNA is kind of an instruction manual, but it doesn't actually do anything on its own. Some of it gets translated into amino acids and makes proteins that go away and do things, but that code has some redundancy in it. So it's quite possible that you can have a change in your DNA that means that you still make exactly the same protein and that nothing about how you function changes at all. So there's plenty of opportunity to have mutations that don't do anything. A very convenient record of the past that you can essentially think of your genome as kind of an historical document where there's lots of mutations there that you might share with other people or with other species as you go further back. And somehow, you know, the number of mutations you share with different species is telling you something about how long ago you had a common ancestor, and that you can use these neutral sort of nuisance mutations, if you like, as a kind of clock that's been ticking along for millions of years and keeping somehow a record of how close you are in an evolutionary sense to every other creature on the planet. The whole field of bioinformatics is actually really recent compared to a lot of other parts of science. It wasn't until the early 50s, I think 1953, that scientists, so Watson, Crick and Rosalind Franklin, who often gets forgotten and all that, were able to work out that the structure of the DNA molecule, and it occurred to them that it could have this property of being able to record information by the fact it's double-strandedness, basically, was important. But then from there, basically the late 60s and early 70s, there were a lot of breakthroughs in sort of molecular science that allowed people to start to work out what those DNA sequences actually were. Well, they really began, I think, with protein sequences because they were a bit easier to work with. And through the 70s and 80s, there was more progress, and it became, just as the years went by, it became cheaper, more efficient to be able to get this DNA sequence information. And it didn't take too long before some people realized that DNA sequences could tell you something really interesting about human history and about broader evolutionary history. And they actually met with quite a lot of pushback. So I think Alan Wilson was one of the first people to pioneer this idea of using mitochondrial DNA. It's this maternally inherited DNA to try and understand human history and promote that out of Africa hypothesis. Anthropologists got extremely upset. They said, well, this is not how you study human history. You do this by going out and digging up, you know, fossils and bones and things. You don't do it in a molecular biology lab by sequencing DNA. You know, how ridiculous. And one of the famous quotes from him is, it's all very well studying fossils, but you don't know that any of your fossils had descendants. At least I know that all my DNA had ancestors. So so it's funny that the information in DNA in the current day has so much to say about the past that, yeah, you can tell all sorts of things. You can tell things about potential sizes of historical populations. So you might be able to detect from my accent that I'm from New Zealand originally. And so the indigenous people in New Zealand, the Māori, only arrived in New Zealand really quite recently in terms of the sort of scale of human migration. And differences of opinion as to how the Māori people may have found New Zealand originally. And so their oral tradition talks about there being particular canoes, so say eight waka that arrived in New Zealand, whereas I think a lot of the early European scientists thought, oh, they must have just been maybe blown off course on a fishing journey or something. But when you look at the DNA of Māori people, you can actually fit sort of mathematical models to that and say, well, how much diversity or how many differences would you expect to see in the modern population depending on different sizes of founding population? And what the science found was in almost total agreement with the Māori oral tradition that, yes, probably there were maybe 80 to 100 maternal founders of this sort of original population, maybe, you know, 800 to 1,000 years ago. So Origin of the Species came out, I think, was it 1865? And maybe not 2 or 3 years after that, a German guy called Ernst Haeckel had come up with a tree of all life. He did this as his PhD project with amazing hubris or ambition. You might say, well, how did he work out an evolutionary tree before we even had DNA sequences? And he was using what's known as morphology, which is basically just, you know, how do things look and patterns of development. And in particular, I think he was interested in looking at embryos of different species, because similarities in those could give you a lot of clues as to how closely different things shared common ancestry. And so still today, if you want to know how dinosaurs, say, fit into the tree of life, then you can't use DNA, you have to use fossils. And so people would use things like characteristics of bones. Do they have a little lump here or do they not? And that would be sort of a particular character that was shared or not shared. The general idea is to look for shared features and to say, if a group of species share some particular feature, you know, one explanation for that is, you know, it's just by chance. But the other explanation is they share that feature because of common ancestry, because of common descent. So you don't need DNA to build phylogenetic trees, but it has quite a lot of advantages compared to looking at bones. So one of the things is that genes are incredibly well conserved across a massive range of species. So humans and bananas share something like 50% of their DNA, whereas you couldn't look at bones of bananas and try and work out how they were related. One really fun example of this is with whales, trying to work out where do whales fit into the tree of life. And it would certainly been established that they were mammals, but used to be thought that they were quite different from other mammals. When DNA sequencing came along, it basically put them in with ungulates, so that's things like goats and deer and sheep, and that seems sort of somewhat surprising. And I think their closest relative turns out to be the hippo. So you can think about what my PhD supervisor used to call the whippo group, the whales and the hippos. And no one had suspected that whales might be ungulates because whales, of course, don't have ankle bones, which is the main way people decide if things are ungulates. But if you go back to a marine lifestyle, clearly ankles aren't much good to you. So that's one of the things that perversely maybe makes DNA really useful for trying to uncover history, the fact that there's so many changes in DNA that don't do anything. They aren't useful, so they're not like ankle bones that are something that's going to be really obviously actually under selective pressure can mutate away and be a kind of a clock or a record of what's going on. So there've been lots of different, I guess, mathematical and statistical methods proposed to try and work out what the best, most accurate evolutionary tree is. One of the earliest and most famous ones is known as parsimony. So parsimony is kind of a funny word. Basically, if you accused someone of being parsimonious, you'd mean they were a bit cheap. then maybe they wouldn't shout their round at the pub or something. And so in terms of evolution, what does it mean to be parsimonious? Is that you're being cheap with mutations. You're just saying mutations are pretty rare, and so I'm going to prefer explanations that use the fewest mutations. So sometimes you might hear this called Occam's razor, or KISS, keep it simple, stupid, that, you know, the simplest explanation is usually right. And so rather than proposing an evolutionary tree that requires hundreds of mutations, we'd rather propose one that maybe only uses 20 or 30 mutations and say that seems like it should be more likely to be the truth. Understanding the evolutionary biology and having the mathematical models is one thing, but actually the other discipline that's been super important is computer science and the idea of algorithms and being able to take your model and actually then turn that into a bit of code or an algorithm that can, say, quickly make predictions or check through different possible arrangements of trees. And so nowadays, if you're studying some particular group of species and you decide to do some sequencing, before you could publish a paper or have that go into the scientific record, you'd be expected to deposit those sequences on a big online database. And so pretty much anything that has had its DNA sequenced, that DNA is now publicly available in an enormous database, can be searched by anyone. For instance, there's websites now where you can download hundreds or possibly by now thousands of different COVID sequences if you want to, and you can get them on your own computer and you can use freely available tools to align those sequences. It's a fantastic example of open science. All these different studies of different species sort of all around the world, you can find the results of those in terms of DNA in a very accessible way. And part of the reason that they are accessible, these large databases, but the other part of the reason is that people have designed very, very clever, efficient algorithms that allow you to search in the same way as can type a search into Google, and a millisecond later it comes back with all of the relevant pages from potentially billions of different pages out there. You can do the same thing with DNA sequences and just pull out the ones that are most closely related from these massive databases. For me, I like to be able to walk around and get this feeling that you're not just an individual, but that you're somehow linked in over these enormous timescales in this big evolutionary process, and that we're all kind of part of one big family, that I can trace my ancestry back and find commonality with anyone, any other human on the earth, or that I can trace my ancestry back and find commonality with all the animals or all the birds or, you know, all the other living creatures. It's such a fantastic idea, and I think it alters your viewpoint on life when you sort of start to see everyone as some very, very large extended family rather than as maybe competing organisms all the time.
Thank you.
Sci Art Walks is brought to you by Beaker Street, a public science and art initiative in Tasmania. Audio editing, music production, and sound design by Chris Townend. Interviews, transcript editing, and curation by Margot Adler. Project management and artist liaising by me, Rosie Pidd. Please help us spread the word about Sci Art Walks by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts and sharing with your friends. A 5-star review wouldn't hurt either. Winky face.